Hello. Welcome to another episode of Equity Merchants. Our guest this week is Adedana Ashagbe, the Regional Director for Africa and the Middle East at Village Capital. Adedana's career has taken some interesting turns, from working as a freelance journalist to now helping entrepreneurs build great businesses. And she shared all that on the podcast. I hope you have as much fun listening to her as I did chatting. But before we get started, please share and subscribe to the podcast. Gracias.
So can you just introduce yourself to our audience?
Hi, everyone. My name is Adedana Ashagbe, and I'm the Regional Director for Africa and the Middle East at Village Capital.
Regional Director for Village Capital. What does that entail? What are your responsibilities?
So I first started off as the Regional Manager for Africa, and then my scope expanded in the past few years. Effectively, It's maintaining the health of the team, and also of the practice, both financially, so there's a lot of fundraising involved. There's media opportunities, including speaking today with yourself, managing the team, so human capital as well, and then also program delivery and implementation, so working directly with entrepreneurs through our various workshops.
Okay, so 2021 was a great year for African startups. We had African startups raise approximately $5 billion, and that was like the first time that was ever happening. And it basically broke fundraising records for like the past 2 years. So what's your take on 2021 as someone who works with founders and someone who works in the venture space?
Sure, right. A lot has happened in the last few years, and you're seeing a lot more capital being raised. I expect the trend to continue. We have a lot of great entrepreneurs who are building really excellent solutions. And so I expect that, I don't know if it's going to be another record-breaking year, but I fully expect that we'll see big numbers like we have for the last few years.
Let's now talk about you a little bit. You studied at Yale for your undergraduate degrees, environmental studies, and you also had the master's in environmental management. But you've done a lot of work in the media, and now you're working with founders, entrepreneurs. So what inspired the move? Why did you decide to move from environmental studies to the media and now to working with startups?
A Facebook post is the quickest, most honest answer. I still care very deeply about storytelling and about narratives and about media, both fiction, nonfiction, documentary. I still do care about that because so much of even working with startups and when startups are pitching, they're telling a story. So it seemed I have strayed in some ways from it, but the heart and soul is still there in the day job. So I did my graduate degree, as you mentioned, and I thought that what I wanted at the time was that I wanted to be a freelance journalist. But in hindsight, I really didn't have the discipline for that. And I thought it was going to happen. I thought, okay, I did what I was supposed to do. I think I had a little too much entitlement at that young age. I just kind of thought that, all right, I checked boxes. I did what I was supposed to do. I've worked hard. So where is this career and dream life that I thought was going to happen? And I quickly realized that's not how this works. and at the time, I could hustle. And so I cobbled together different communication jobs for African startups. But it wasn't, kind of the long form journalism that I thought I was going to be doing. And so it was about a year after graduation, which in some ways was really beautiful. I was with my family, and so I had extra time with my parents after many years of being abroad or out of the house due to college or to undergraduate and graduate studies. So in some ways, like, that was a really beautiful season in its own way. But then realizing that, okay, something has to change. I'm not exactly sure what's going to change, but, what's happening now can't stand. And so a friend of mine posted something on Facebook. Here's the part about the Facebook post. And it was supposed to be a 3-month position in Nairobi. working for an organization called the African Leadership Network, and I would be an intern. And you know, I thought, okay, great. You know, I've packed up and moved before. I lived in China. I worked in South Korea. I was in Ethiopia for a little bit. I traveled however many countries by that point. So the idea of picking up and moving on short notice wasn't actually foreign to me. But within 2 weeks, I was in Kenya. And I remember I was going to a wedding that I had already scheduled to go to. And I brought all of my suitcases to this wedding, and my friends were really confused. And they're like, where are you going? Like, why? You know, we're just here for 2 days. Why do you have three suitcases? And I remember kind of telling them then, oh, by the way, I'm moving to Kenya. Update, you know, life update time. And then 3 years became, or sorry, 3 months became 6 years. And so I was at the African Leadership Network for 2+ years. And around that time, there was a lot of activity happening with startups and such. And also being in the ALN sphere had kind of maybe oriented me toward business just because of who the members of that organization were and the people that I was coming across on a day-to-day basis. And so I was just really interested in the startup world. It seemed pretty exciting. I wasn't directly involved in it, but I was in a sense through human capital, because my last role at the African Leadership Network was managing a program that brought young diaspora business leaders from the United States to various startups for short-term placements across Africa. And so I was familiar with startups through my work, but I hadn't worked at a startup myself, and I hadn't worked for a fund, and I just wanted to get a bit of exposure to that world. And then Village Capital, I got headhunted through a recruiting agency on LinkedIn. And I really didn't think I thought they reached out to me for my network because of, you know, the human capital work that I had done. So maybe they wanted new candidates or people that I could send their way. And so I was in that interview not expecting anything to be about me at all. And then it took maybe 20 or so minutes for me to realize, oh, wait, this is about me. And so the benefit of not thinking it was about me at the beginning is that I wasn't nervous. You know, I was just myself. Yeah. I was happy to help and, you know, okay, what do you need here to, you know, this is, you know, I'm happy to introduce you to people, et cetera. And then once I figured it out, I thought, oh, okay, never mind. I've got to get my act together. So, oddly enough, when I hung up the phone, I just knew that this was it. Like, I had a feeling that this was the opportunity I was supposed to have. And then lo and behold, I was hired, and almost 5 years later, here I am. So it's been quite the journey. And I'm very grateful.
Yeah, that's quite an interesting journey, and to a large extent, I can relate to it. So you just mentioned something that I was going to ask you about. You've lived in Kenya, you've lived in Ethiopia, you've lived in China, South Korea. You speak Spanish and you speak Mandarin. So that's like enough for me to be envious about. So I actually wanted to learn how to speak languages. I think when I was getting into university, I wanted to be able to speak like probably 6 languages by the time I was 30. And here I am, I still can't speak more than 2 languages. So basically my question is, there's a lot of thoughts about how you can build for the African market, but a lot of the time it's going to take you a while to like see serious less gains. So a lot of the infrastructure or the factors that could make businesses or startups wildly successful are not yet available. So it's like you know you're building now, but you may not be seeing the gains for about 5 to 6 years if you're lucky. So there's an argument that founders or African founders should attempt to build for a global market. So even if Africans can't afford your products at this point, then you know that you still have a product that people on a global scale can use. So what do you think about African founders building global products that can be used by anyone anywhere?
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, I think obviously every founder has to make a decision for themselves about the type of company they want to build and who their most valuable customer is and who they want to serve. you know, every founder doesn't have to have the goal of global domination, you know? I mean, again, this is really independent. This is very specific to each person. But to your point, you know, why not aim high? Why not aim for beyond your country's borders, beyond your region, beyond your continent? You know, around the early days of Facebook, there were Facebook-like platforms in South Africa. There's no reason that those platforms that were out of South Africa couldn't have been what Facebook is today in terms of the wide access or the, you know, the huge. So I think it is helpful to think that way, especially because, you know, one of the things that I often speak to is how Africa can be more self-sufficient. And being able to export platforms, software, technology, products, hardware, you name it, or entertainment, creativity, etc. That is helpful in the long run toward building prosperity and building prosperity that is resilient and that can withstand the shocks of a global pandemic, of supply chain issues, of borders being closed, of xenophobia, et cetera, et cetera. So building for a global market, I think, is a great idea. Again, if that is what you want to do. And it's also perfectly okay for a founder, if they want, to focus on their own borders or their own communities or wherever it is that they can gain revenue. I think you just have to decide, you know, if you do want to raise funding, if you're raising funding, you're going to have to make some promises for that. And so are those promises that you're willing to keep? And if you're not, or, you know, you just have to find someone that's willing to dream the way that you're dreaming. And that's okay too.
You just mentioned now that you didn't exactly point it out, but Africans have been, to a large extent, been able to export music, entertainment from here out to the outside world. Like, to a large extent, African music and entertainment is global. So what do you think it is about the music industry that helped it to go global that startup founders can leverage on or learn from in order to build companies? Because I think one of the problems is probably not having enough understanding of how the whole world works. So I don't know if you can build a solution for a problem that you don't experience. So what do you think that it is that helps put African musicians and then foreigners to build global businesses?
Well, simply put, in terms of why, you know, Afrobeats and music is doing so well, it's because it's fun. It's fun. Mm-hmm. You don't need to understand people's problems, you know, for that. People want to move. Mm-hmm. People want to move. They want to have a good time. People really want to have a good time now. I mean, people have always wanted to have a good time, but, you know, in recent years, it's not as easy to have a good time in the traditional sense, depending on where you are and what your risk profile or your risk appetite is for being outside and breathing air. So it's easy to understand music because music is a universal language. Yeah. And it's been quite impressive to observe in the last few years just how quickly you now hear Afrobeats on radio stations in the United States, in Europe, etc. Something that, you know, a child of Ethiopian immigrants being, you know, born and raised in the United States, I don't think I really ever expected that. It's not that you didn't have major African artists, of course you did, but to watch, you know, TikTok challenges being set to African music, to watch artists on late night TV, you know, late night chat shows. That's pretty impressive. And that's all happened in the last few years. But there was also, you know, that didn't happen by accident. The entertainment industry has been really doing a great job of promoting itself and getting in rooms and building spaces also for themselves. So the short answer is that it's fun. Music exports itself almost because it's fun. That's not to say that you can't build solutions that are more impact focused and still be successful. But I think there is something to be said about, you know, building, what about video game companies? What about fashion? You know, the other ways that people find joy and pleasure and levity, and building that, building companies around that, and seeing what happens there.
Okay. All right, so let's talk about Village Capital. What's the Village Capital investment thesis? So how do you guys invest, and what drives you to invest in startups?
Sure. So taking a step back, Village Capital was founded in 2009 by two co-founders, Victoria Fram and Ross Baird. And in short, they wanted to democratize entrepreneurship. You know, they realized something that we all kind of know now, which is that entrepreneurship, or rather ideas and talent, are all around the world, but the opportunity to do something with that talent, to grow and scale your ideas, is not as equally distributed. And so they wanted to see, what if we put the power to invest in the hands of entrepreneurs? What if we had cohorts of, let's say, fintech entrepreneurs that would get to know each other, that would, over the course of however many months, perform peer due diligence, ask pointed questions, rely on their previous experience and their current experience as entrepreneurs in the same sector to evaluate and vet? And what if we allowed them to rank companies after that process? And so that's what Village Capital did. And so you would have the top two companies ranked by their peers, be eligible for investment by VillCap Investments, which is the affiliate fund. And so we're currently now in a family of friends strategy. The fund is now focused on follow-on investment, but for quite some time there, almost 10 years, there were new investments being made in new companies. And so the investment thesis, or the investment committee, were really the entrepreneurs that were part of the program. So in terms of the thesis, it would be more important to speak about, or be important to speak about, the how founders got into the program to begin with. And so they would usually have ideas or businesses rather that were at least a year in operations and post revenue, although we did have some pre-revenue companies involved, and we've even had a pre-revenue investment as well. Again, because the cohort themselves decided that it was a strong idea, and a strong founding team. So really just the key, simple but key building blocks to what can make an idea take off. And so we have now been in existence for 13 years. The Africa practice has been in existence for 10 years. This year is our 10-year anniversary, which is something that we're very proud of, to have been a part of this journey. And me personally, to also be proud of, to be part of half of Village Capital's journey in Africa, as I hit my 5-year anniversary this year. It's pretty special all around for me as well.
All right. By the way, congratulations on your 50th anniversary and the 10th year.
Thank you.
Village
Capital.
Appreciate it. Okay. All right. So earlier on, you mentioned how a lot of your work has to do with storytelling, because you work with founders, and then when they get to pitch, they have to like tell a story about their business. So almost anyone can learn storytelling. So when pitching to investors, how do you know that a founder is genuine and they didn't just learn storytelling in order to convince investors?
I don't go into rooms being worried about that necessarily. I mean, because even if you do learn how to tell a story, everything has to be true. So I don't mind that someone learned how to tell a story in order to pitch or to speak with me. I mean, do whatever it is that you need to do to feel more comfortable in rooms where maybe you're scared to be in. So I don't begrudge anybody any opportunity to improve themselves. That's totally fine. I think it's just what is more important is the content of what you're saying. You know, who you are, why did you build this company? Because you could spend your time doing anything, but you've decided to do this. Being a founder is not easy. Being an entrepreneur is not easy. It can be very lonely. It can be a very taxing process and isolating. And so, you know, in light of the fact that you could probably be anywhere, you're doing this. So what is that reason? You know, why do you believe in this so much that this is what you're spending? You're foregoing stability, you know, you're foregoing you know, some sure bets maybe, in order to take this path. So telling me about that, telling me some of your numbers, you know, that's all fair. And that's typically what you would hear in a pitch. But typically, you know, what sticks with you are people's stories of why, you know, of why they've done what they've done, how effectively they, you know, the journey that led them to speaking with you in that moment. That I always find pretty fascinating.
Okay. So storytelling can, although it can be manipulated or used just for a particular purpose, then it's also possible for you to find out how genuine someone is.
Okay, interesting.
All right, so VC firms usually have like an investment thesis that guides their activities. So some of them are sector agnostic, while some would only invest in biotech companies or stuff like that. So personally, what guides you in your work with entrepreneurs?
In terms of sectors that we operate in?
No, just you as a person. Adedana as a person.
Oh, what drives me in my work?
Yes.
That's interesting. I don't think anyone, I've been in a lot of interviews. I'm not sure I've heard that question before. So well done to you. What drives me in my work? I really root for the underdog in my personal life. I like to see people win that you wouldn't expect to win, or that people maybe would ignore because they don't look like winners. And that's effectively what we do at Village Capital. You know, we're all about the underdog. And so that aligns and falls pretty spot on to kind of just my general way in the world. Helping founders that are, you know, maybe not in big capital cities, who maybe wouldn't have access to the mentors and resources that people in bigger tech hubs get to benefit from. And how can we spread access to investors and mentors and stakeholders and advice and potentially capital in some of these cities, in some of these towns, in some of these countries that where activity isn't the highest. And also, you know, that's just geographic diversity, but there's also educational diversity. You know, there's also gender diversity. There's all kinds of ways in which people can be marginalized. And we really do our part to try to help, to help the underdog. And that's something that I can and do get behind.
All right. Okay. So building on that, what entrepreneurs of all the entrepreneurs that you've worked with, which one of them have you had yourself rooting for so strongly, like you really wanted to do all you could do to help them succeed?
So pick one entrepreneur?
Yes.
That's really hard. There's been a lot of programs over the years. So there was an entrepreneur who had he was in our fintech program. We had a foreign exchange product based in Kenya. And you know, every time there was a request for an introduction, et cetera, you know, I would do my best to make it happen. And this is not, I mean, this story comes to mind just because I remember some of the conversations that he and I had and some of the things that he went through and the challenges that he faced as a founder. But ultimately, you know, any request that you get, you really do try to honor it. You know, people don't ask for help lightly. Or sometimes a lot of people don't, you know, for some people it's really difficult to ask for help. So by the time someone has said, hey, you know, I could really use this introduction, or I could use, you know, this, that, or the other, I really do try to honor it as best as I can. I wish we could do more. You know, we only have so much time with all the programs that we're running and all the things that we have to take care of. But yeah, that founder in particular comes to mind. I really wanted that. I mean, I want everybody to succeed, and I want, you know, all these good ideas to flourish and thrive ultimately. Yeah. So I that one comes to mind, but there's many more where that came from.
Okay. So this particular founder, how did his business finally turn out?
So unfortunately, it didn't take off. That's a real story. You know, I think people see, you'd like to see the fruits of labor and you like to see the happy ending. But as many as you know, as many people know, in this line of work, sometimes that just doesn't happen. It could be regulation, it could be funding, it could be human capital. I mean, there's so many different reasons. And of course, it could also just be fatigue. You know, it's not easy. It's really not easy to do this all day, every day. You know, manage a team, try to raise funding, build your business, and then also be a human being. You know, people have families. It's not easy by any stretch. So, you know, that's also a very legitimate reason. Like, you tried and it just didn't work, so you move. You know, there's always a move until there isn't. And so, you know, getting to that point where you realize, having the self-awareness to know that, you know what, you've tried everything, it's not going to work, that takes a lot as well.
That's kind of interesting to learn. So we always or almost always focus on just the people who get to succeed, whose businesses take off, and there's like a ton of people who their businesses never get to take off. They had great ideas and everything looked like it was going well, but for some reason it just didn't work out. So it's actually interesting to learn about that. All right, so let's look at something else. What are the sectors that excite you in Africa, apart from fintech? I mean, everybody's excited about fintech, but apart from fintech, what other sectors excite you the most in Africa?
That's funny that you said fintech. It's not that I'm not excited about it, but I actually, if you didn't prompt me, I wouldn't have said fintech, actually.
Oh, perfect.
I like the spaces that we're in now. I really like future of work. I think it's a really exciting place. You know, education, employment, you know, how to upskill talent, how to maintain, retain talent, how to provide better benefits. You know, you're seeing a lot of emphasis on workers' rights at the moment in a lot of different parts of the world. And there's a lot of solutions around that. Which I find fascinating. I think that's probably what excites. If you told me to pick one sector, that's one. Mm-hmm. If I get a second one, back to my original, you know, something that I said earlier, I really like to see ideas that are based around fun and creativity. And I would like to see more of those. And I know they're not quite in the scope of Village Capital, so maybe I wouldn't work with them, you know, one-on-one. Or as part of my day job, but just seeing in the news or seeing progress of companies like that always excites me, because I think that's just as important as the serious stuff.
Yeah, I think that's important. But for some reason, we have like very few people building solutions for creatives in Africa. So I think that would also be exciting to find out. Okay, so building on what you just said, we have like you mentioned two things: the future of work. And earlier you also mentioned how you like rooting for the underdog, and so we have a largely youthful population in Africa, and for some reason there's just very little progress made to prepare this young population for the future. I think by 2050 we are going to have the largest young population in the world. So that's like a very serious concern. And on the other hand, we also have very few women working in tech or in venture capital. So What do you think can be done first to bring more women into this space? And second, training anyone, upskilling people is tough, and a lot of the time you don't get to see immediate returns. But how can we encourage people to actually build solutions that solve these two problems?
So there was a few questions in that question. I'm trying to figure out the best way, like which one to take apart first. Okay, so can we go step by step? Give me the first question within that group.
All right, so the first one is about women and how difficult it is to find women in the tech space. So what do you think that we can do to ensure that there are more women in the tech space, or at least in the startup space?
So I actually don't think that there's too few women in the tech space. So when you say that there's too few women in the tech space, what do you mean by that? I want to make sure that we're talking about the same thing or we have the same definition. Do you mean developers? Do you mean founders? Do you mean founders that are getting money? When you say, what do you, just give me a little bit more context on that and I'm happy to respond.
Okay, so on a general note, so we have less female developers, we have less female founders, we also have less female founders getting money from investors. So like generally, or at least compared to the men, we have significantly less women in this space compared to men.
And so you want to up the numbers of women?
Yes. So if you wanted to do that, what do you think should be done or can be done? Although you are probably the first person who says they don't think there are like very too few women in the space.
Well, the thing is, I'm also based in Nairobi, and so maybe that has skewed my opinion, but I'm on panels with women all the time. I'm in meetings with women all the time. Most of the people that I talk to work-wise are women. Again, I think I'm coming from a very particular ecosystem. And granted, I do Pan-African work, but in terms of my day-to-day meetings, a lot of folks are women. You know, even in terms of who, you know, when I'm doing fundraising, you know, for the organization to raise money for our programs, a lot of those people are women too. So I'm not, I don't want to say that there are, I'm not saying that there aren't gaps at all. There are, but so many of the people that I immediately think of when I think about my work network are my fellow women who are crushing it and who are either starting funds or working at funds, or running their businesses. So I think if you want people to show up, you have to be welcoming. People don't go to a party if they don't know they're invited. Yeah. You know, you got to invite people to the party. If you really care about who shows up to the party, then you got to send the invitation and make sure people feel like they want to stay when they're there. And that's not a woman thing necessarily, or just a woman thing. That's a, you know, diversity of any mark, of any kind, you know, whether it's gender you're thinking about or education level or life circumstance or sector, etc. There are a handful of opportunities for women who want to learn how to code. Making people aware of what the opportunities are. And if you really care, because I've been on, I think I was on a gender lens investing panel a few weeks ago, and a similar question came up about, you know, what can be done about investing in women, because the numbers in Africa are quite low. In a lot of places, not just in Africa. And I just said, you know, at this point, how many panels do you want to have about women investing in women? How many panels do you want to have about investing in local African founders? You know, my first podcast interview 5 years ago was about investing in foreign founders in Africa versus local founders in Africa. So we've been talking about this minimum for 5 years. You either want to do it or you don't. And that's fine if you don't. Well, maybe it's not fine, but it's a fine. You know what I mean? Like, you know, then just don't talk about it. You know, like you don't have to say anything. You can just do your business And, you know, that's it. You don't have to make any proclamations. You don't have to make any promises. If you really don't want to do it, then just leave it alone. And for those who do, you do it. You know, you give money to local founders. You give money to women founders. So, you know, it's really not that complicated at this point. Especially, you know, you just mentioned the record amount of funding that's coming in. At this point, these are conscious decisions being made. It's really not that hard.
Okay, that's interesting. I think what you just said, if you want someone to come to a party, then send out the invitations. I think that's very interesting. I should tweet that sometime. Okay, so the second part of the question was on how we can get more African youths to be ready for the future jobs that will be created, and that cuts across every part of Africa. So how can we get more African youths to actually, or at least more Africans, to build solutions that upskill these youths?
Again, we ran a future of work cohort last year. We're running a future of work program this year. We might run a third as well. You know, there's the Jobs Tech Alliance from Mercy Corps. I don't really know if the problem here is that there aren't enough people building solutions in future of work. I mean, we've gotten a really good amount of applications. The solutions are there. It's just, do they have the opportunity to scale? Do they get eyes from, you know, investors, stakeholders, et cetera? And, you know, a lot of what you're asking is actually not really a startup problem. It's a government problem.
Yeah.
You know, we have a tendency to ask a lot of entrepreneurs to solve all the problems. And at some point, there has to be some government planning and forethought about who is in the country, what kind of jobs are needed, what kind of education is required for those jobs, how accessible is said education, and what you're going to do to make it accessible if it's not accessible. You know, startups can't, you know, bottom up everything. At some point, you need to look at what curriculum is, because who has access to that? That's a government, that's a ministry. That's not a startup who can dictate what your curriculum is in any given level or grade. And that takes planning, that's leadership, that's governance. And I want to caution, and it's fine to ask questions about what entrepreneurs can do, but for some of these things, the question should be asked in equal measure, well, what can government do? Because that's a few ministries involved in that problem right there.
Okay, I think that's fair. All right, I think that's all the questions I have. Thank you so much for your time, and I hope you can do this some other time and then get to catch up on what Village Capital is doing.
Sure. Well, thank you so much for having me. I hope this was helpful.
It was.
I hope the audience enjoys. Thank you again.
That's it for today's episode. I hope you had a great time. Please leave a review, share, or subscribe to the podcast. Bye.